This is the Marketing Podcast Network.
Welcome to Uncorking a Story, the podcast that introduces you to the rich world of storytellers who share their personal journeys, creative processes, and the stories behind their stories, one conversation at a time. I'm your host, Mike Carlin, and I'm thrilled to be part of your writing journey. If you're an aspiring writer, a literary enthusiast, or simply someone who believes in the transformative power of words, you've come to the right place. Every week, we'll pop the cork on the world of successful storytellers and give you a healthy pour of inspiration, insight, and empowerment. My mission is to help writers like you realize your full potential through the transformative and therapeutic power of writing. Whether you're just starting your literary voyage or looking to refine your craft, I'm here to provide you with the knowledge, inspiration, and encouragement you need to embark on your own storytelling adventure. So, are you ready to uncork your story and let your creativity flow? Uncorking a Story is about to begin. Sit back, relax, and let the transformative magic of storytelling whisk you away. Welcome to Uncorking a Story. Reginald L. Reed is an author and an accomplished professional in the pharmaceutical industry. He joins me today on Uncorking a Story to discuss his memoir, The Day My Mother Never Came Home, in which he recalls the events surrounding the unsolved murder of his mother and the subsequent indictment and trial of his father 32 years later. Welcome to Uncorking a Story, Reggie.
Thank you, Michael. I appreciate it.
Yeah, no, I appreciate it. I know it's early where you are, but I'm curious, where does your story as an author begin?
Well, it all started when, I've been basically followed by my mother's tragedy all my life. You know, when she was murdered when I was six, and over a course of time throughout my life, you know, things just kind of settled in and the case went cold. But a few years ago, I got a strange call from local law enforcement in Louisiana stating that my father was indicted for the murder, which was very shocking, if you could imagine. And that's when I just said, you know what, the story was out, you know, a lot of media attention. And at that point, I said, the only way to combat this now as an adult is to write about it, you know, and really tell my own story. So I just took on the task and built up the courage to just get a pen, get some paper. I'm saying that old school, but literally, you know, I got some pen and paper and also my computer and just start writing away.
So I think we have to take a trip back in time here. So if you allow me to use a Back to the Future reference, we have to get into our DeLorean and go back in time a while. Tell me what was your life like during that period of time? I mean, you're 6 years old and I mean, your mother leaves one day and doesn't come home. What was that like growing up?
You know, Michael, as I can remember, it was very chaotic. You know, at that age, you really trying to decipher what's really going on. I recall myself viewing an interview, you know, maybe a month after she was murdered with one of the detectives, just kind of giving me some, you know, questioning me about that night. And one of the questions she asked was like, who's currently at your house? And I paused, you know, I was going through the list. I was like, my dad, my dog. I had a golden Labrador named Duke. I was like, Duke. And then when I got to my mother, I kind of looked at my dad and was like, and my dad was like, no, she's there. She's there in spirit. You know, so to your question, it was just very chaotic, very confusing. And it just seems like life, just looking back, just kind of life just molded itself and just kind of took literally a life of its own without my mother present.
I mean, did you at that time have a sense that she was, you know, gone for good? But like, what, you know, just paint a little bit more of a picture of like, you know, what was happening?
Yeah, I don't. And again, You know, I look at my son now, he's 4 and he's a mama's boy, right? When mama goes to the store, he's like, where's mama? You know, and I take myself back in time. I'm like, just most recently, just kind of think about what I was thinking at that time, because I really wasn't sure. You know, when the news first broke, I think my emotions were kind of carried, and they kind of latched on to my the people I was surrounded by emotions. Because at 6, you really don't know. You know, I'm not hearing that she was murdered. She was found in a car with over a dozen stab wounds. I'm not hearing all these graphic details. I'm just knowing that she didn't come home.
Yeah.
And I think after the funeral, maybe I had a little bit more clarity. But like I said, as time unfolded, you know, I just noticed that she was not present anymore in our lives. And it's just my dad and I. I think the realization eventually came to light, if you will, just for me realizing that she's never coming back.
Yeah. Did you have no brothers and sisters or only child?
Yeah, not at that time. My dad never remarried. I was the only child from my mother and father. Later, I had other siblings, but they're basically step siblings.
Got it. So now we're going to go forward in time, and you're an adult, and you get this call. Was that the last thing you thought? You know, you pick up the phone and all of a sudden you've got this news that your father's been indicted. Was that the last thing that you thought that call was going to be about?
Well, yeah. So let me just step back a little bit.
Yeah,
so
please,
throughout years of my life, I was raised, my dad and I, we lived in a small, quaint community in Hammond, Louisiana. The neighborhood we lived in was 100% African-American. You know, I was raised humble beginnings, you know. And I could count on maybe 2 hands. You know, you hear these rumors, you know, as they refer to it as street talk or gossip. You know, you hear these things and, you know, I just, as a kid, you know, I'm trying to be a kid as much as possible. And I heard a couple times, you know, that my dad had something to do with it, but I just kind of brushed it off, you know, and just really didn't pay it any attention. But back in 2010 is when I moved to San Antonio. 2 years after I had, you know, made myself home in a new city, I got a knock at the door, like after a long day at work, maybe 5:30, I got a knock at the door. It was a Texas Ranger who is like the state troopers in the state of Texas. So obviously I felt uneasy then, because I'm thinking like, why is a Texas Ranger with a cowboy hat at my door? I'm thinking like, what did I do? What did I didn't do? I'm thinking I'm in trouble. And I kind of felt he was uneasy as well. But he, long story short, he introduced himself and just, I invited him in, and he just like, you know, I just want to ask you a few questions about your mother's murder. And I was like, I was shocked at that point. Like, you know, why is this all of a sudden coming back up? And he just showed me a couple pictures and asked me a few questions and so forth. So at that point I was like, oh, I guess they're just kind of reevaluating the cold case. Cause at that time the case was cold. So fast forward a few years ago, again, I'm working and I was actually at a hospital working at a meeting, and I get a call, and it was basically quote unquote a courtesy call from the law enforcement in Louisiana saying your dad has just been indicted for the murder of your mother. And right then time just stopped. If you can imagine, like, yeah. I was like, is this a prank, or like, why would somebody prank like this? You know, so it was just time stop. And again, my world, my life has been flipped upside down.
Yeah, I'm curious about the presence of the Texas Ranger, because the the murder happened in Louisiana, right?
Right. So I give you a little context. What happened was, and all this was unfolding in the background, and I didn't have any idea that, you know, it was being looked into again. So at that time, I think a major hurricane was approaching Louisiana, but the initial goal was for the state, Louisiana state troopers, to fly out to Texas to meet with me. But based on the weather conditions prohibited them from coming out. So they coordinated with the local law enforcement, which was Texas Rangers, and like, hey, can you meet with this guy? This is what we're working on, so forth, so forth. And that's what brought the Texas Rangers into the picture, because when I met the gentleman, he asked me a few questions and asked, would I be willing to come down to the substation for a more formal interview within like the week or so. And I agreed to that. But one thing was weird is that they wanted to do a hypnosis interview. I didn't agree to that. I thought that was kind of strange. I'm like, no, I get weird out about that type of stuff. I'm like, I don't want to get hypnotized and never come back to my real self. I'm like, so I passed on that, but I did do just a regular interview, just kind of talking about what I remembered back then. So anyway. Right.
And that's where we're talking like 30 something years before you're in there, you're trying to.
Yeah. They asked me like, what do you remember about that day? What did y'all go to the mall? Was your dad in the car? Was there any certain smells you remember? You know, this is all detective work, right? This is, you know, like you see these shows, First 48, and you know, the good thing is I wasn't the suspect. I'm like, so, right. So I feel more at ease, but it's still uneasy because, you know, I don't remember, you know, one thing I remember that sticks out is that my dad and I was at home playing Nintendo. You know, as a 6-year-old, I was big on video games. We were playing Nintendo. I think it was like a baseball game I had just recently got, and we were playing Nintendo and fell asleep, woke up. Mom wasn't there.
Wow. So I have to ask about your dad. Like what, you get that call, you know, your dad's been indicted. What, I mean, did you have a conversation with your dad after that? Do you have a chance to talk to him or?
Yes, I did. Obviously, after the process of the intake process, if you will, of the jail, maybe close to 48 hours, I finally received a call from the jail, and it was my dad. And my dad's a Marine. You know, he doesn't break or bend under pressure. You know, all my life, that's what I know my dad as. Like, he does not let you see or anybody see him sweat. You know, so I'm like, the world could be falling apart and he's still like even keel. Like, he's just like, hey, it's okay. So that's what the initial conversation was like. And he kind of gave me some suggestions on like who to reach out to, and so forth, you know, just like some people that he knew like locally, just to kind of get more information. And time just kind of went on, and before you know it, we're 11 months in and he's still in jail with a $250,000 bond and awaiting trial. And I do want to point out, like, this was in the midst of COVID. You know, so what I did, $250,000, when they put a bond of that capacity on you, that means they don't want you to get out.
No.
You know, so, you know, and typically the bail bondsman require 10% of that. So I was able to move some things around financially, and I just came up. I was with the thought process that, you know, my dad's old. It's COVID. You hear all these stories how bad COVID is in jail. Say, you know what? I can eventually make more money, but if something happens to my dad, I can't get my dad back. You know, so I was able to, you know, move some things around from a financial standpoint and bail my dad out after about 11 months of sitting in jail and have him get prepared to fight his case outside of jail versus inside.
Yeah. Wow. I can only imagine, you know, the trauma you felt at six and then having it come right back to you, you know, 30 or so years later. What was the trial process like?
You know, but besides the fact, you know, when my mother was murdered, that was like the second worst day of my life. I would say it's like the worst day of my life because, you know, as an adult experiencing something like that versus a six-year-old, just like we spoke about earlier, you know, it's just kind of, you're trying to put the pieces together as a six-year-old. You're trying to understand what's really going on. But as an adult, seeing your dad, my father, who raised me, you know, get sentenced to life in prison is, you know, I can't really, you know, put a word on it, but it was one of the worst days of my life. The trial lasted for right at a week, you know, and you're throughout that time period, you know, I recall my dad and I building up a quick tradition. It kind of reminded me of when I was younger, you know, before school. You know, I went to a Catholic school. The bus didn't come in our neighborhood, so my dad had to take me to school every morning and pick me up. But one of the things we had going was we'll go to McDonald's, you know, maybe three times out of the week, you know, sit there and eat, and he'll bring me to school. And throughout this week in trial, you know, that was we quickly established this routine where we'll drive to a city right outside of Hammond, which is called Ameet. That's where the parish courthouse is. And we'll stop at McDonald's, get a bite to eat, and then head to trial, you know, head to court. You know, I didn't really have a big appetite, so I just got like a hash brown or something. But we did that consistently from that Monday all the way up until that Friday. And the worst part was when they read the verdict, you know, and, you know, again, my knees locked, time paused, and they read the, you know, and I just kept, I was just kind of in a stare, just looking at my dad, and then the bailiff coming over, you know, putting the handcuffs on my dad taking out his belongings. And I just reverted back to emotionally of when I was a six-year-old. It was a point when I was watching that video that I spoke about earlier where they were questioning me and I just had an outburst and just was crying. And said, I want my dad, I want my dad, I want my dad. And my dad was in the room. And during this trial, that's what happened. Like, I went up, the attorney kind of, well, waved me up, said, hey, you want to say bye to your dad? And I went up, and that's when I just lost it.
Yeah.
He, you know, he hugged me, he kissed me on the forehead and said, it's going to be okay. Again, the world's falling, and he's telling me, it's going to be okay. I'm like, whatever. And I just recall myself just crying, and they escorted me out because I was just way too emotional. And I was just saying, I want my dad, I want my dad, I want my dad. And that was it. And one of the other worst parts is driving home, you know, without my dad in the car that night. Like, that was weird. You know, it's like every day you know, we're driving together. We come home and I drop him off at the house. I was staying with a friend, but that Friday night, after 3 hour deliberation of the jury, just and after everything settled, I went home. My dad wasn't there, but his scent was still in the car.
Yeah.
You know, it's cologne, and it was just, it was horrible. I don't wish this on anybody.
Yeah.
Yep.
Wow. So when do you start thinking about writing a book about this, all of this, and memorializing it?
You know, just really when everything just came out as far as the indictment, and I knew that, okay, things are getting real, and people calling me, I'm looking on social media, Facebook, you know, local media's putting stuff out. You know, former candidate for mayor, because my dad ran for mayor of Hammond, and they, you know, they put all these headlines. A former mayor candidate indicted for wife's murder, and blah blah blah, and people commenting. It's, you know, it's haywire. And these days, it's like it just literally a story just takes off like wildfire, right? And I'm just like, man. You know, I have to find a way where I can, you know, a process that helped me heal through this. Cause I knew this was going to be a rough ride. And for all my life, it's like, I guess housed my own story, my own feelings, and how I've dealt with trauma throughout my life. And I just, something just hit me, say, you know what? And I'm this is my first book. I'm not an author. I was like, and actually I'm not a big reader, you know? And I was like, I don't know how to write a book. I don't know what to do. So I just kind of did some research and just built a team, you know, I hired a copy editor, hired a writing coach to help me kind of put everything, you know, contextualize everything. And I just got to work.
In what ways, if any, was the writing process therapeutic for you?
Just really, you know, all my thoughts and all my feelings just basically putting it out there, just kind of releasing it. You know, because things like this, you know, I have my wife, you know, which is, you know, she's been the ultimate support system. But just as a man, you know, it's like some things, it's like you don't want to appear as weak, and some things, you know, you want to talk about, but you don't want to talk about because you're afraid of what somebody's going to think. So that's why I just say, you know, I'm just going to just take on a task. And like I mentioned earlier, I just built up the courage to just really put it all out there and just really tell my story. And by writing, and throughout that process, I'm talking about it. You know, I'm talking more to my wife about it, telling how I feel at this moment, how I felt at this moment, and so forth. And that was just the, I guess, the motivation for me to complete this memoir. And you know, it was a very cathartic process. You know, you hear people say, oh, you don't hold in your feelings. You got to talk about it. You know, I've been to counseling before, like throughout the period when my dad was awaiting trial, and I talked about it, and that helped, you know, a little bit. But you know, I just went down this road, and here I am. Now I have a book, and one of my main goals is just encourage people in general. Just, you know, you gotta tell your story. You know, we're in a time of, you know, the social media days. Everybody's, you pull up, all you're seeing is positive stuff. Everybody's taking trips. Everybody's life is great, right? But I just want to encourage people, like, you gotta tell these types of stories, because you never know who you could help. Because someone could be going through something far less worse and hear my story and be like, you know what? I'm doing okay. Well, I'm not doing that bad.
You're right. I think there's a lot of people walking around thinking less of themselves because they go onto Facebook or whatever, Instagram, and they see these people living these glorified lives.
Yes.
And, you know, they think, hey, my life isn't like this. What's the matter with me? But, you know, it's not as if, you know, Instagram and Facebook are actual mirrors to ourselves. It's basically right. The false reality that so many people are living. But at the same token, I imagine this is a book you never really wanted to write.
Yeah, it was. You're right. So I would say, if things wouldn't have unfolded the way they did, I probably would never wrote a book.
Yeah.
You know, but hindsight, you know, things happen the way they did. And this was one of the only ways I saw that I can like combat the trauma. Cause I wasn't, and that's how I've really been my whole life, you know, just, and that's one of my motivations outside of my family is just realizing the things I was without growing up, the things I didn't have, the things I didn't want, and the stages of life where I wasn't happy. And I said, you know what? I don't want to relive that. You know, I don't want to relive that trauma. I want to do better, because at the end of the day, it's all up to the individual. It's all up to you, me, you know, to determine how we want our life to be, you know. And I took the high road and just said, you know what, I'm not gonna. Because I was telling somebody the other week, I said, you know what, if I would have ended up on drugs or maybe alcoholic or whatever, I would have had a pass. And what I mean by that, you know, they would have looked at me, and I say they, people would have said, you know what? I see why he's the way he is, because he's been through so much. You know, his mom was murdered and this and that and that. And I didn't want to fit into that statistic. I wanted to change the narrative of that.
Yeah. I mean, they do say, by they, I mean these experts, you know, trauma begets trauma, and you know, mm-hmm. it's a cyclical thing. But it sounds like you made a very conscious effort. And I know you mentioned you have two young kids at home, to sort of break that cycle, if you will, so that they don't have to experience what you had. And that's a beautiful thing. It's a hard, I'm sure it's hard, but to even think about, but it's a beautiful thing.
Yeah, it's challenging. You know, I still have challenges. You know, I still get, you know, my dad, he's serving life in prison. You know, he calls maybe every 3 days, maybe longer, depends on when he's allowed to use the phone. And you know, a lot of people wonder, like, well, why do you still talk to your dad? And I'm like, it's easier said than done looking on the outside. You got to remember, like, this is the guy that raised me. You know, he still maintains his innocence, you know, but it's like, I can't go from one day to the next thinking like, oh, this is my dad. Now he's a monster. Like, which is, it's very confusing, very complex. You know, it's things that, and people ask, you know, in all transparency, like, hey, do you think he done it? Or, you know, and I'm like, well, you know, as a realist, you know, looking at the evidence, sitting through the trial, I'm like, it's a lot of things that came out. It does not look good, you know, not in full transparency, you know, but it was no smoking gun. When I say that, it, you know, everything was circumstantial evidence. It wasn't like, hey, I saw him, you know, take your, you know, but they did have a co-defendant who was involved, and he gave a testimony testifying against my dad, saying he was, you know, he did everything, he orchestrated everything, and they basically gave him the charge. Initially, they charged them both with second degree murder and conspiracy, but later they dropped the conspiracy for both and charged them second degree. And based on the co-defendant's testimony, they let him go. They gave him time served and just charged him with think it was, I think the formal term was like accessory to something like that. But
so they, how did they get to him? Was he in prison for something else at the time?
No, interesting story. And I'll make it quick, but when at the crime scene, when my mother was found in her car, you know, one of the pieces of evidence was a cigarette butt. Back then, DNA wasn't, you know, prevalent. I forget what year DNA actually came out, but they later retested this cigarette butt. And I don't know. Yeah, that's what it was. So they retested and he was already in the system for some other crime or whatever. But he has a twin brother. So the DNA match hit for both individuals and they found this guy homeless under a bridge in Atlanta. That's where he was found and they extradited him back to Louisiana. And one of the statements he made in the interview was that he was the key to it all. And he testified during trial and the rest is history. But it all started from a cigarette butt, to answer your question.
Oh my gosh. All from a cigarette butt.
Cigarette butt that was found right outside the car. Yep.
Wow. Well, you know, this is some process you've gone through. It's almost at a loss for words for it. But you know, the show is called Uncorking a Story, and we do feature conversations with authors, and you know, this was certainly one heck of a story to uncork. I am curious, like, what advice would you give somebody who is looking to, you know, get their story on paper and write their memoir? What would you tell them?
I would say, you know, just like anything else, you have to start somewhere. You know, a lot of times in life, we think about all the things we don't have or all the resources we don't have. You know, you have to take what you have and you just have to start the process. And I say that, I don't want to make it sound easy, but that's what I did throughout my life. You know, I took the cards that I were dealt and, you know, I realized that it's life after trauma. So, you know, I wasn't given this perfect, you know, I'm not a card player, so I don't want to use a card analogy, but I wasn't given a perfect royal flush, if you will, or whatever, you know, the perfect hand would be. You know, my cards are all messed up. And, you know, I took what I had and just made the best out of it and just, you know, said, you know, I'm gonna get to work and be better. So I would share that. If you have a story, you know, especially like the messy story. I refer to, you know, that in my book. Like, we gotta tell the messy stuff. Because this is the stuff people want to hear. People want to hear, like, how do you overcome? We don't want to hear, oh, you were raised with, you know, your parents were millionaires and now you're a billionaire. Yeah, that's great. You know, but these are the real stories. Like, how do people really make it through life? Because the majority of people, we're normal. And when I say normal, like, you know, I don't know what the percentage of millionaires, billionaires, whatever. It's like, I'm an everyday person. You know, I just built a successful career and family despite the tragedies that I'm surrounded by.
Yeah. And I think that's a big story in and of itself. You know, how you were able to do that. Do you address that at all in the book, you know, in terms of kind of working, you know, having this success in life in spite of your past?
Yes, I do. You know, I talk about that throughout, you know, and it's really just to sum it up. It just, you know, I hate to, you know, but like I kind of mentioned earlier, you know, nobody else really cares. You know, it's all up to you, you know, and, you know, I'm a big believer in my faith. you know, and I just like just put my head down and just got to work, you know. And like I mentioned earlier, my motivation was the things that I didn't have and the things that I wanted to achieve. Because I'm going to be honest, Michael, I don't know if, you know, if my life was perfect, and I'll say perfect in reference to what happened, but like if this tragedy didn't happen, if like my mom and dad were still together, I don't know if I'll be the same man that I am today. I don't know. I don't know. You know, one of the learnings and environment that I was raised in was I was raised to survive, not live. That's how my dad raised me. You know, it's a lot of things. It's a lot of positive that come from that. It's a lot of negative. You know, my wife always coaches me on, you need to be more emotional and blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, well, I wouldn't, you know, I didn't have that TLC, right? You know, one of the things I reference in the book, it's a chapter called, You Know I Love You. And that's really referring to, you know, the connection, the emotional connection my dad and I had. You know, he never really said, I love you. And it's amazing. It's putting that one word in front of that. Amazing the difference that it makes, right? Versus, you know, I love you. It's kind of like, you know, I love you, but it's like a but versus saying, I love you. So that was the environment, you know, so, you know, I grew up fast, if you will.
Yeah, I can only imagine. Where can people pick up the book, Reggie?
So it'll be available Amazon, Barnes & Noble's website as well. And also, I have a pre-order being available April 8th at rlreed.com. That's my website. So I will have pre-orders and a signed edition available, hardback copies available starting April 8th. But the official release date is May 21st, and it'll be available via Amazon and other book outlets. But I say Amazon because mostly people, when you want to get something, you just go to Amazon. But it will be available at BarnesandNoble.com. But people will have access to purchase it.
All right. So I will be sure to put a link to rlreed.com in our show notes for people to look up, as well as a link to the book on Amazon and some other outlets. The book is The Day My Mother Never Came Home. The author is Reggie Reed. Reggie, thank you for stopping by Uncorking a Story and letting me uncork yours.
Thank you, Michael. Have a great day.
Thanks for listening to Uncorking a Story. If you'd like more information about today's guest or to find out more about Mike, go to uncorkingastory.com. If you enjoyed the show, please subscribe, rate, and review us at Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Tune in every week to hear Mike Carlin uncork a new story.